Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host, Lucas Servodio, pouring you an episode that's one part gin, one part Campari, and 100% guaranteed to get you ready for the weekend. From the Negroni to the Espresso Martini, Italian cocktails have taken Los Angeles by storm in recent years. Our guest today is Paul Feinstein, the author of the upcoming book, Italy Cocktails, an elegant collection of over 100 recipes inspired by Italia. Paul is a renowned food and travel writer with bylines and publications ranging from BBC to La Cucina Italiana. He spent months singularly focused on compiling the best recipes and stories associated with Italian cocktails. The end product is a gorgeous book that I'm predicting will be one of this holiday season's hottest culinary gifts. In my mind, Paul is kind of like the Dos Equis most interesting man in the world of food and travel writers, so we also talk about how he found his way into this globe-trotting line of work. We talk about which travel experiences most deeply impacted him, which types of stories he most enjoys writing, and how one particular food writing assignment almost brought him face to face with his maker. So head to your bar cart, dear listener, fix yourself a stiff drink, and prepare for a doozy. Without further ado, let's chow down. Joining us today on the LA Food Podcast is the author of the upcoming book, Italy Cocktails, an elegant collection of over 100 recipes inspired by Italia. You've also seen his food and travel writing in places like BBC, Travel and Leisure, Fodor's Travel, Time, and Zagat. It's Paul Feinstein. Paul, how you doing today?
I'm great, Luca. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So where are you calling us from today? Which part of town?
I live in the middle of the city, somewhere between the Beverly Center and the Grove.
Nice. And I always ask this because I'm interested to know what people who love food eat on a regular, on like a daily basis. We're recording this a little after lunch. What did you have for lunch today?
Oh, no, you don't want to know. I just had some, I had leftovers because I went to Marvin last night, which is a local neighborhood French restaurant. They just have amazing pastas and steak frites and mussels, and they have these good toasts, and just this like lovely wine bar French restaurant on Beverly and Crescent Heights. So I went there last night, so I had leftovers today for lunch.
That's actually a great answer. I don't know why you were afraid to share that. I feel like leftovers from a nice French restaurant is a perfectly acceptable answer.
It is perfectly acceptable. You're right. I shouldn't have been ashamed of it.
Yeah, I'd wear that as a badge of honor personally. Paul, I forget. Did you grow up in Los Angeles?
I've been here for 23 years, but I grew up in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're from Denver. I forgot about that. So you've been here for 23 years, though. So you are bona fide Angeleno at this point.
I consider myself to be an Angeleno more than anything else. I've lived here longer than anywhere else. And I've been a Laker fan since I was 8 years old. So, you know, it still runs through my veins.
Did the Laker fandom cause you to move to Los Angeles, or were there other reasons?
No, I mean, I always was drawn to this place. Lakers didn't hurt, but no, I originally moved out to LA to work in entertainment. I was a TV and film writer for almost 10 years before getting into food and travel.
Did you always want to go into the industry as a kid, or did you have other aspirations first?
I think since probably, yeah, I don't know. I think probably since high school, I really wanted to be in entertainment as a writer, and yeah, I just pursued that. I didn't go to, you know, like a top tier film school or anything, but I always wanted to be here to be writing for a living.
Was there a like moment or a piece of cinema that inspired you more than others when you were growing up?
It's so funny you say that, because I'm literally reading the like the oral history of the movie Airplane that just came out with the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams. And that movie, I think alone, just, you know, it inspired me to write comedy in a way that no other movie ever did. It was that probably in Caddyshack and Animal House and Spies Like Us and early 80s comedies. But Airplane is really, to me, the quintessential greatest comedy ever made. And that is really what inspired me to come out here and write.
I really love that. I feel like a lot of times when I hear people talk about the things that drew them to become writers, it's always some really serious, like, dramatic film or director or something. You know, if I were to say what inspired me to get into comedic writing, if I were to ever do it, it would be a film like Superbad or something, right? So I'm not putting Superbad on the same level as Caddyshack or one of those classics, right? But I do appreciate that you can point to something with a bit of levity as the thing that inspired you.
Yeah, I mean, to take it even one step further, my first agent that I ever had was at Paradigm. I don't even know if they exist anymore, but at Paradigm Agency, and the reason that they signed me was because I wrote a spec on or a script on spec, which is called just writing a script. It basically means you're writing a script for no money. You're just trying to get attention. And I wrote a spec script for Hot Shots Part 3, which is in the same vein as Caddyshack of just like that slapstick, and that's what got me my first agent in Hollywood.
That's amazing. Did you, for that, do you write a whole movie?
Yeah, you write a whole movie.
Wow, I've heard people do it for like an episode of a show. I didn't realize you did it for a whole movie too. That sounds like a fun but time intensive way to spend an afternoon.
You want to get noticed. Sometimes you gotta do whatever you can. And
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, no, you got to put in the work. So, let's talk about your foray into the world of travel and food, which is what you're known for today. Were you into food growing up? Was it something that you like were gravitated towards or seeked out in a particular way?
no, not only was I not into food, I was probably the worst eater in the world. Like I was the person who like whose food couldn't touch each other on the plate. Basically like pizza, hot dogs, chicken fingers, French fries. That was my diet. I didn't eat a cheeseburger until like late in high school because I thought it was weird to mix meat and cheese, and for some reason, I don't know, that was just in my head. And I didn't become a like an adventurous eater until I moved to Los Angeles. And I was out one night with some friends, girls and guys, and we were at this place called Miyagi's, which was on the Sunset Strip. I think it's where Pink Taco is now. So it was like a clubstaurant, as they call them, but like for sushi. And I thought eating raw fish was the weirdest thing in the world you could ever eat, but I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of a bunch of girls. And so I tried the most basic, like tuna, nigiri, sushi, or maybe it was even like a cut roll. And I loved it. And from that moment on, I said to myself, if I can eat raw fish, which at the time I thought was the weirdest, it's clearly not even close. But at the time I thought it was the weirdest thing. But I said, well, if I can eat that, I can eat anything. So anytime someone would put anything in front of me, I would try it from that point on. But I didn't, it's still from there a long ways to go before becoming anything like a gourmand or knowing about food or being a foodie. That was just the beginning of my adventures into food, you could say. Yeah, I just didn't want to embarrass myself. That's all.
Well, if I recall correctly, your first love and one of the things that, or at least that got you into the food world as well, was your love for travel. When did you catch the travel bug?
That's a good question. So in high school, between junior and senior year of high school, all of the local synagogues in Denver like send a big group of kids to Israel for 6 weeks for the summer. And we're not going to talk about the current political crisis, and but this is just my story. So anyway, so I spent 6 weeks in Israel, and it just frankly it blew my mind. Like I just didn't, I really hadn't been out of the country except for maybe Tijuana in Mexico, but like I hadn't really been out of the country to see new things, experience new things, and it just blew my mind. And so, to make a really long story short, between high school and college, I got into a program that sent me to Israel for a year. And that year, it was like a program that where they really want you to stay. So it's like, here's a piece of everything you'll get if you come to live in this country, which is I was working at a middle school for 4 months in what's called a development town. It's where like new immigrants go to they teach you Hebrew, they get you a job, they set you up in an apartment. And so I did that for about 4 months. I did a semester of school in Jerusalem at Hebrew University, studying about history and geography and philosophy and Really, that's how I know about so much about this Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I did 6 weeks of basic training on an Air Force base, which was pretty crazy. And then I did 6 weeks on what's called a kibbutz. For your listeners who don't know, it's sort of like a communal farm in the middle of the desert. I mean, they're all over Israel, but mine was in the middle of the desert. So after that trip, I went to Egypt, I went to Jordan, I went and did my backpacking trip through Europe, and that's really where I got hooked on just wanting to see and experience as much as possible. And then I went to college in Washington, D.C. When I graduated, I worked in L.A. for about 4 years before I decided I the travel bug, it was still in me and I needed to go. So I quit my job. I sold my condo, I sold my car, I sold all my furniture, and I traveled around the world for a year by myself.
Did anybody try to stop you?
No one tried to stop me, but people thought I was crazy. Because I mostly traveled just in, developing world and third world countries. So it was a lot of Africa, a lot of Asia, a little bit of the Middle East. So I didn't, it was really hard travel. I got sick a bunch of times, almost died a couple times. But it was, I just missed it, and I just at the time I needed something to like shock my system, and it was traveling around the world for a year that did it. It was great.
This is probably an impossible question to answer, but among all those travels, is there a place or a situation that stands out?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a pretty broad question, so it's a little hard for me to answer. But because there's so many things that stand out. Traveling, up the Nile, on the little boat, and thinking I was gonna, smoking weed with like the Nubian like boat, driver as we were going to like these 5,000-year-old temples. It was pretty crazy. Going to the rock-hewn churches in Lalibela, Ethiopia. I mean, just you've never seen anything like it. Falling in love with multiple girls along the way, and all that's obviously that's always a fun part of the travel. But probably all of Africa, I would think, would be the most formative stuff for me. Like Egypt, Ethiopia, doing walking safaris in Botswana and South Africa, and getting charged by bull elephants. Like there's nothing to protect. I mean, it's just like stuff like that is just really cool and different, and I highly recommend for anybody to go do.
Yeah, you were a long way from Denver. What was your plan after this? Like, was your plan to come back and just pick up where you left off with your career?
It was Egypt that inspired me to write my another spec script, which got me repped at William Morris, and got me back into that world, and was writing and writing and writing, and nothing ever got made, but enough close calls that kept it interesting, but also enough close calls that sort of like, I don't think I want to do this anymore.
When did you decide
That
to pull the plug?
was probably around 2009 or 10, and it was right around that time I started a company with a couple other guys called Party Earth, where we were reviewing the best bars and clubs and restaurants and things to do and places to go in 19 cities around the world. And the conceit of the site was I could tell you where to go based on your mood or your personality. So like sometimes people want a dive bar, sometimes people want a nightclub, or that's just like your thing, period. I could tell you based on who you are, how you feel, where to go on any day of the week. And so I was in charge of all the content. So I was managing, like 50 writers around the world, writing articles, editing reviews, just thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of content that we ran for about 4 years, raised a bunch of money, and then ran out of money, and then took a little time off.
It's the story of fledgling media companies, right? Really tough industry to make it in. How did you get that off the ground even? Like I think a lot of people can start a website and start to, put out content, but how did you actually go about taking that from an idea into something that was a reality?
It was me and these two other guys who I knew well, and we, I guess like everybody in the early 2010s had startup fever, and the three of us really complemented each other's skills. Like, one guy was in, you know, he was the tech guy, I was the content guy, and then the third was really like the finance guy. And so we, you know, sort of just put our minds together, and we honestly, we worked 100 hours a week until we could raise enough money to really, you know, build it and hire the right people. And yeah, I mean, it's just running it. It's like going to business school. You learn a lot of lessons, mostly what not to do. But, you know, I feel like I went to 4 years of business school. It made me 1,000 times better as a writer, as an editor, as a manager, just being able to, you know, deal with different types of personalities and people. It was really, even though it failed, I don't consider it a failure. I think it was probably the most important thing I did professionally to get me to where I am today.
Well, clearly it didn't scare you away from writing, because, you know, it seems like it kind of just whetted your appetite in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you work 90 to 100 hours a week for 4 straight years with no breaks, you know, the burnout is real. So I took like a year off after that, and I traveled a bunch again, went to Asia and Southeast Asia, and just sort of, I did a lot of travel in Indonesia, Thailand, and Japan. And I got a call, from my current editor now at Photos Travel, who said, "Hey, we know what you did for those 4 years. Our food writer dropped out. We need someone to write 100 restaurant reviews in a month. Can you do it?" And I said yes, and so that's what got me into the freelance writing world and food and travel.
That's bonkers. 100 reviews in a month. How do you even begin to tackle a project like that?
So it's funny. He called me. It was right around Thanksgiving, and I said, "Send me the list of what you guys have currently." And he sent me a list of like 100 restaurants, and 50 of those restaurants I knew really, really well, and thought, yeah, these should still be in, you know, the guide, and I can rewrite them, and I can polish these up, and no problem. That was like the easy part. The hard part was then the other 50 restaurants, which all had to go because they either weren't relevant anymore, had closed, or, you know, had other problems for whatever other reasons. And so I had a month to do, basically to go to 50 restaurants and then write those additional 50 reviews. So, look, I'm a grinder. And so I look at a project and I know exactly how long it's going to take. And we'll get to my book in a second. I'll explain. There'll be a pattern here. But I was doing breakfast, lunch, dinner every day, sometimes double lunch, sometimes double dinner. And, you know, you can, when you have a real hard deadline, which was for me, I think it was January 2nd. So I had the entire month of December to just like bang it out. And fortunately, I had really good contacts and people who helped, and I was able to just plow through LA in a way that I had never done before. And it was great. I loved it. I got super sick and almost died from a parasite. But besides that, I turned my guide in on time. And from that point on, because of that work, like my editor there, you know, he said, "Look, we, you know, whatever you want to do, like you're in." You know, it was doing that and getting it done and doing it on time and doing it well that ingratiated myself to him. And to this day, he and I are as tight as can be.
If I recall correctly, there was a little bit of a snafu towards the end of this project that almost prevented you from turning it in on time. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, long story short, I got sick around Christmas. And by sick, it wasn't food poisoning. I just had a fever every day for like 4 or 5 straight days. And finally I went to the urgent care. I was like, 'cause I don't know what was wrong with me. I would wake up every morning. My sheets would be soaked in sweat, and I was still going out breakfast, lunch, dinner every day. 'Cause I would take some Tylenol. My fever would go down to 99. I just didn't know what was wrong. So they said, "Oh, we don't know what's wrong with you, but we'll take some blood." And this was on like New Year's Eve day. So the 31st, and I go home, I sleep again, like wake up, sweat soaked sheets. And the doctor calls me and says, "Hey, you got to go to the emergency room." And I was like, "Why? What's wrong?" They said, "Well, your liver is inflamed." And I didn't know what that meant. I said, "Well, what is that? You know, what does that mean?" They said, "Well, you have enzyme levels in your liver, and normal is between 0 to 60. I said, "Okay, well, what's mine?" And the doctor said, "800, go to the emergency room." So I don't know if you've ever been to the emergency room on New Year's Day, but it's a trip. It is the worst place to go because everyone is, a wreck from the night before and it's just packed. And I was not an emergency. I had a 99 degree fever, so they're like, you got to wait. So I have my laptop and I finish writing my guide in the emergency room, and I finally go in. They take my blood. They say, we don't know what's wrong with you, but your liver's inflamed, and so you have to stay. So I'm in the hospital for a week, and that night I turned my guide in, so that was on time for the next day. And for the next week, I was like Dr. House mystery patient, where every doctor in the hospital is coming to try and figure out what's wrong with me, because I still have a fever. It won't break. It just will not break. By the end of that week, so it was like 2 full weeks of fever, they said, go home, but you got to keep coming back every day to keep doing more tests. After about another week, they finally figured out that I had a parasite that's called Toxoplasma gondii, which you can get from raw meat or raw lamb. And they said, what did you eat? I said, well, how long is the incubation period? And they said, it's like 2 weeks. They said, so what did you eat? And I looked at my calendar and I went back, and I'm pretty sure it was from this off-menu lamb tartare from Tar and Roses in Santa Monica, but it's not like food poisoning. You don't know right away. It's like I ate a million things in this month, so it could have been from anything, but I'm pretty fairly confident it was from that. But it wasn't even on the menu, so it's not like, what are you gonna do?
One of my least favorite games is trying to figure out which food gave you food poisoning. It's one I've played many times, especially in Mexico, and it's honestly like whack-a-mole.
Yeah, but this isn't food poisoning. I mean, this is different. It's like this is
It's
it's a whole different thing. Like, yeah, I mean, how do you, it's 2 weeks for it to take effect. So like it's tough. Yeah. I played that game as well, but this one was, if you were a baby or really old or had a compromised immune system, this kills you. So they would like pump you through it full of drugs, but there's nothing. Like I just passed it, my antibodies went into action and figured it out. So
Yeah,
good
well,
times.
if there was ever any doubt about you being a grinder, I think this definitely proves your case. So
Yeah.
obviously, this project opened up a bunch of doors for you in terms of being able to continue to do this on a regular and full-time basis. Since then, you've worked on a ton of types of different stories. It seems like every time you post a story, it's a cool and interesting new angle, like going to like that resort in Mexico, which was kind of like a day camp but for adults. There was you've done awesome interviews. I'm curious, what's your favorite type of story to work on?
There's a couple different ones I really like. I think my favorite is when I really get to do a lot of research where I really don't know. Like I'm really interested in a topic and I don't know a lot about it, but I've found some weird like way into a story that I've pitched that some publication said, yeah, that sounds cool. We want you to write about it. And then I can like really do deep dives and talk to experts. I think, I really love talking to people who are like singularly focused on a thing that they're just the best in the world at. I'm really attracted to that kind of person who is just, they dedicate their entire life to this thing. In Japan, there's this word called ikigai, which is basically like a reason for living or a reason for being. And that word, encompasses like someone's entire life work into a single thing. I just interviewed Anthony Mangieri from Una Pizza Napoletana in New York, and he's one of these people. I mean, he doesn't know it, but he has, it's ikigai is what he lives by, and it's just he is so singularly focused on improving his pizza for 30 years, and that's why he's the top rated pizza in America and also in the world. And so, people like that I love to talk to, but who help me like inform a bigger story about, a bigger topic that may have more symbolism or more meaning.
Those types of people are, it feels like they're a dime a dozen in food. Like, just so many chefs out here have such a singular, like, attention to do like detail or focus and fanaticism about what they do. I that's one of the like reasons I'm really inspired by this world is just, again, meeting people who have that ikigai, to use your Japanese term that you pulled out of nowhere.
Yeah. But Luca, here, I've written a lot about Japan. Well, but here's the thing: like you say that they're not actually a dime a dozen. It might seem like they are, but there's only a few that are really different and really unique. Like I'm sure you've seen this around LA, where you just see menus that just copy people, and all they do is take someone else's great idea and try to put their own spin, or maybe not spinning it at all. And I just think these people, they're unoriginal, they're uninteresting. Yeah, they work hard and they want to do well, but all they do is copy and steal from other people. And I don't think that's I like I they're not in that category. Like there's only so many originals. Like I talked to a chef. I won't tell you who it is because I don't want to besmirch his name, but I went to his tasting dinner, and he serves one of the courses. It's like a 20 course thing. One of the courses is an A5 Wagyu from Kagoshima, which is it's the best A5 Wagyu beef in the world. And but in Japan, like A5 Wagyu, no one eats that. Like they give it to people, it's given as a gift, but it's really hard to eat. Like you eat a bite or two, and it's so heavy and it's so fatty that it tastes amazing, but like you can only eat a few bites of it before it's just too much. And so in Japan, that's not even like a thing. So, for me, I like an A2 or an A3, which is sort of it's less fat, but it's closer to like, the top rated, like you and I, we went to Matu for their cheesesteak. But their beef, like if you go there for dinner, like you'll see it's 100% grass-fed Wagyu beef from New Zealand. So like an A2 or A3 is closer probably even to that. And I asked the chef, I said, why are you serving, A5? He's like, well, that's what people want. I said, well, what do you like? Do you like A5? He's like, no. He said, I actually really like A2 or A3. I said, so why don't you serve A2 or A3? He said, well, because that's what people want. I was like, yeah, but isn't it your job as a chef to like educate people as to other types of ways of eating this stuff? And he said, look, if I charge people for A2 or A3 the way I charge for A5, there'd be a riot. And all I can think of is like, this is your job. Like your job is to educate the populace. It's not to go by whatever the most popular thing is of the day. That like literally Anthony, when I interviewed him again, I'll just go back to this line, is that unprompted, he said to me, in this interview when he was talking about his pizza, he said, all I do is I taste my pizza, and if it tastes good to me, I know I'm doing something right. I've never thought about awards. I've never thought about public opinion. I've never thought about all these things. I know if it's good or not. And if people like it, that's great. And I'm really happy that they do. But that's my barometer is me. And so like there's only so many of those that are really, all they really care about is their own palate, because they're geniuses on some level that, most of us can only dream of being.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. And also, you are also correct in your, assertion that it's not a dime a dozen. It is rare. I guess maybe I just feel like in Los Angeles we have quite a few of those people, like who do demonstrate that. It's not everybody, and it's not on every block by any means.
Let me make an analogy for you. Okay. All right. So I think about it like this. Are you a fan of basketball? Do you watch the NBA at all?
I am, but although I'm a Clippers fan, I apologize.
No, no worries. It has nothing to do with the team. So let's pretend you're the best player ever in your middle school. You're the best player ever in your high school. No one's ever been as good as this kid. The best player, he's an All-American, goes to the best school, best college. He's the best player in college, and he gets to the NBA, and he looks around and he sees LeBron James, and he's like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? He might be the 50th best player in the world, which, by the way, is unfucking believable. If you're the 50th best player in the world, but you're never, ever, ever, ever going to be in that top five. And there are tons of chefs in LA who I agree with you are phenomenal and will be in that top. They'll be all stars. They're all stars, but they'll never be superstars, or they'll never be MVPs. Like there's just a level of like there's really, 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 really good, and then there's just different. And I think on the just different, there's
Well,
only so many.
and you don't think we have any just difference in Los Angeles?
I'm not saying that. No, I'm not saying that we don't. I think we do. I actually think we have a few, but I'm just saying that there's just not that many of them.
Yeah. I get that. I get what you're saying. Yeah. I thought you were about to make the case that like nobody in Los Angeles is just different. I'm like, now that's a take, Paul. That's a hot take right there.
No, I think we have a few. I think we have a few, but I don't. I think just to get to that final level, and again, it doesn't have to be like, oh, I got a third Michelin star. It could just be you make the best whatever thing is that no everyone's anyone's ever had ever. Like, you know, I mean, I love the Italians more than I love anything else, and so I think there's a few in the city that are on that level. And I think Daniele Uditi is on that level. People don't know this, that he's like a French trained chef who's just like. He makes pizza and pasta that you've never had any. I mean, I've never seen a chef like him before. That's why the entire city copies what he does.
Yeah, I mean his pasta nights are amazing. Like one of the best culinary experiences you can have in my book for my money. Yeah, I hear you. I think we have some special chefs here too, but now I'm going to be thinking about who are those LeBrons? What is that Mount Rushmore? Look, I want to make sure we get to this topic because it's something that I am really interested in. And you bring up the fact that you're a bit of an Italy file, which I think is one of the reasons why we get along so well. And you've just spent a lot of time immersing yourself in an Italian topic for your new book, and that's cocktails. I want to hear how did this book come to be, and what can people expect?
Here's the book. It's a beautiful hardcover. It's got this nice die cut out. It's 400 pages, 130, I think, or so recipes, 40 profiles of the best Italian bars and bartenders and liquor brands. Okay, so the story. Look, I've been writing about Italy for years and years and years and years and years. And in December, this is another grinder story you'll appreciate, Luca. So in December, I get an email from a HarperCollins email address that said something to the effect of, "Hey, we've been reading a lot of your stuff in Travel and Leisure and wherever else, and we think you'd be perfect to write an Italian cocktail book." And I was like, is this spam? I don't know what I was like. Did I just get a book deal? I don't know what happened. It's literally the middle of December. And so, you know, obviously I write back. I've never had a more flattering email. I said, thank you. What does this mean? What's the deadline? What's the expectation? What's the pay? And they said, well, the deadline is March 15th. And I'm just thinking, like, March 15th, 2024? And they're like, no, March 15th, 2023. I'm like, it's December 15th. So I'm like, December, January, March. Like, okay, so I have four. Okay, but the end of December is worthless. So I basically have 3 months to write this book. And they sort of laid out how they wanted me to write it. And I didn't like that layout. And they tell me what they were going to pay me. And I didn't like what they were going to pay me. So I said, look, I have to, if I'm going to do this book, I want to do it in a very different way. I want to lay it out in a very specific way that I think makes sense for Italians and Italian cocktails. And I need a little more money because I have to drop everything else I'm doing in order to do this, which they said, you know, thankfully they said yes. And so basically starting right after New Year's, I had two projects at the same time. So every 2 years I also write the Photers Print Guide to Los Angeles, at least most of it. I couldn't write as much of it this year, but that time of the year had come as well, which also had the exact same deadline. So basically for 3 months I had to write two books. So from 5 in the morning till noon, I would be on the phone with all of my Italian contacts, doing interviews, doing research, making drinks. And then from noon to about 10 o'clock at night, I'd be going to lunches and dinners and touring hotels and seeing things to do in LA and writing those reviews. And I did that every single day, nonstop, for 3.5 months and hit both deadlines and turned in a 500-page book. They said it was too long. I had to cut about 50 recipes. And so it's a 400-page book instead.
I hope you took a vacation after that.
I did. Not a long one, but a short one. Look, it was the book was so fun. I, I didn't get to travel to Italy to do the book, but fortunately I've been to almost every one of these bars already and these hotels already. And the way the book I laid it out was, I traced the history of Italian cocktails, which is really fascinating. I tell people how to set up their bar cart at home. I have a whole section on classic Italian cocktails. So, your Negroni, Negroni Spalliato, Americanos, Bellinis, Rossinis, Hugos. I have a section on aperitivo, which is the art of drinking before dinner and whetting your appetite for dinner. I have a section on classic hotel bars in Italy, which is really where the hotel or where the cocktail scene in Italy really lived for a long, long time. Digestivo, which is digestivo, is art of drinking after dinner. And then I have a section on all the Italian liquor brands. So there's, profiles of Martini and Rossi and Campari and Aperol and Cynar and Liquori Strega and, name your Nonino Grappa. And then finally, it's like there's a whole section on sort of the future of Italian cocktails and the experimental stuff that really cool bartenders are playing around with in Italy right now. A few profiles of American bars. There's a few actually here in LA, a couple in New York, and some other random places around the country. But that's it. I dive deeply into my Rolodex of Italian contacts, and I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote.
And I'm assuming you had to try a lot of cocktails at home too, as you just said. How did you like manage to do that without getting like absolutely hammered every day? Or was that just like part of work was just getting hammered every day?
No, you spit it out.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. And
Yeah,
that's why
that's
you
it.
have the job and I don't.
No, like the same thing with the food. Like you can't, you go to these tastings and you go to these meals and look, I have the coolest job. I love it. I get free stuff all the time. But like I'll go to a restaurant and they'll give me the menu, but you can't eat the menu. You have to take a bite and you take the rest of it home. So like my refrigerator at home is filled with boxes all the time of leftovers. Like last night, I have leftovers. You have to condition yourself to do that. I have fellow travel writers who don't do this and who have gotten gout. And it's like gout. I mean, this is some medieval shit. Like I, you really, you have to pace yourself. Yeah, I had to test all these recipes. So like I had to spit it out.
It feels like Italian cocktails are really having a moment and have been having a moment in LA for the last few years, I think it's fair to say. Well, maybe like in the last year or two, definitely like in a more acute manner. And it feels like we've all had the opportunity to learn more about things like Negronis, and it feels like Aperol is everywhere now. What was something you learned that surprised you while you wrote this book that you think most Angelinos might not realize as they're heading out to Capri Club or, whatever bars are hot right now doing this kind of stuff?
One of the questions people asked me about this book was how, like, there aren't 130 Italian cocktails, right? And yeah, they're kind of right, but they're also not right. The one thing that people need to understand is that the cocktail ingredient engine is Italy. Like, vermouth was invented in Italy. You can't have a martini without vermouth. You can't have a Manhattan without vermouth. Like vermouth is, it's like the most important cocktail ingredient in the history of cocktail ingredients, and that's Italian. The Italians were making gin and didn't know it. They were making like juniper liqueurs like for hundreds of years and didn't realize that that was basically gin. They were just, because like the Italians were really experimental with all of these, botanicals and herbs and spices that they were mixing together for medicinal reasons, but also, to get drunk. And they had all this really fun, interesting stuff that the rest of the world was using for their cocktails, while the Italians were just sort of sipping neat or, drinking it on the rocks, maybe with a little bit of soda water, with an Amaro here or a Grappa there, a limoncello here or there. And like they just didn't have a cocktail culture until much, much later. Like cocktails were not really an Italian thing. If you wanted real cocktails, you had to go to five-star hotels in Rome and Milan and it just didn't really exist to the common person. I think that was the most interesting thing to learn about, was there was really this inflection point in like 2009 or 10 in Rome with these guys who would, you know, all the best Italian bartenders had all been working in London and New York and in Paris. And they all came back sort of, you know, after the recession and said, like, why could we not get any of this stuff outside of the hotels in Italy? And they started a revolution, and it's called the Jerry Thomas Project in Rome. And they basically kicked off, you know, what is now, you call it modern day cocktailing. It's not, it's the Jerry Thomas was a famous bartender for like the 1920s. And so it's basically modern cocktailing that goes back to what like classic cocktailing really was. It's just that Italy never really had that scene outside of the hotels.
Do you think it has to do with the stereotype that Italians are just like into, like, because you brought up while you were talking about the layout of your book, something that hadn't occurred to me is, yes, Italians very much do have an art around drinking at every single part of the meal, around it, before it, after it. You know, there's probably like a specific drink to have in the afternoon. You know, if you want, you could probably have something in the morning too. Like, do you think that it's also because there was this culture of just drinking wine at meals that the cocktails kind of weren't in favor?
Yes and no. So like, obviously you don't have, like, it's very rare to find any sort of cocktailing that goes with dinner. There's a couple of cool bars that have popped up in Italy where they're doing like cocktail pairings with a meal, but that's just not normal in Italy. It's actually pretty rare anywhere, but really, really not normal in Italy. Like, you would just drink wine with dinner. But like the purposes of the, you know, cocktails, if you want to even call them that, the drinks in Italy were, they all had reasons for being. So, you know, aperitivo, you know, drinking a Negroni, it wasn't to get drunk. It was literally to get you ready to eat. Like, that's its point. That's its purpose. The purpose of that drink is to get you ready for dinner. It's to get your stomach to start moving in a way that gets you hungry. That's why they give you salty snacks to go along with it. You know, it's like, that's the whole point. And then likewise with, you know, after dinner drinks like an Amaro or a Fernet or whatever, the point of those cocktails is to help you digest your food. Although scientifically it doesn't make a lot of sense. You talk to some people, they'll tell you that, who are, you know, bigger degrees than I have. But the point was to sort of wind you down. Like the espresso martini, which, by the way, that's an Italian cocktail. That is not the regular thing. That's for clubbers. You know, it's like, if you want to go out, yeah, you have an espresso martini after dinner, but that's not the point. Was always to sort of like bring you on this journey through food. And, you know, everything in Italy is related to food. And so it was always about getting you ready to eat. Once you eat, winding you down and helping you digest. And that was just the point.
Yeah. Very much a culture built around food. I also loved that you just said, that Italians had created certain spirits without knowing it. That is so Italian. Letting somebody else own something that we created, like, you know, letting Evan Funky make the most famous cacio e pepe in Los Angeles. But that's neither here nor there. I did want to ask you, did you discover any new favorites while you were working on this book?
Yeah, look, I discovered a lot of like new, I mean, they're not new, they're new to me, like specific like liqueurs and vermouths that I really like, and I mostly drink just on the rocks. Like I really love Chinar, which is an Amaro that sort of, it has an artichoke on the label. It doesn't taste like artichokes, but there's an artichoke botanical in the Amaro that I really like because it's bitter. I really like Fernet because it's bitter. But I think if there's a cocktail that I just sort of fell in love with in general, there were two. It was probably the Boulevardier, which is a Negroni that's made with bourbon instead of gin. And then just a Bianco Negroni, which is a Negroni that uses a really dry vermouth and super dry gin and like a fat washed Campari. So it's like it's really clear. To get, you know, it gets rid of all like the coloring, and it just like it takes everything down to its essence, and it's just like a really bitter cocktail. Like my favorite recipe actually in the entire book is on the last page of the book. It's the very last recipe, and it's actually from Damian here in LA, which is not an Italian restaurant. It's Mexican. It's modern Mexican, but it's called the Imaginary Friend, and it's like a version of a mezcal Negroni. But the ingredients are Yola Mezcal, Carpano Bianco, which is Carpano's a dry vermouth, Dolom Blanc vermouth, and Sailor's Gentian liqueur. And that's a French liqueur with like, it's a little bit herbal and citrusy. But this was like the perfect, for me, it was like the perfect distillation of everything I had done for like researching this book. And I had it right towards the end, and I was like, I need to put this in my book, because it's like the perfect Italian cocktail that, you know, it's only slightly Italian, but it was Italian enough for me.
That is funny. There's not a natural, like a very natural sort of marriage between a lot of Italian and Mexican foods. Like, you know, we've seen it a little bit. There's a Mexican Italian fusion restaurant right here in Highland Park called Amigo More. But with cocktails, it makes sense. Like mezcal does seem to work really well in the Negroni, and I feel like that's something you see on a lot of menus these days.
Yeah, it's like, look, it just, you know, the smoky with the bitter with a little bit of sweetness. I think it's just a fun combo. I don't know. I really like mezcal Negronis in general, but that one in particular, if you go to Damian, order the Imaginary Friend. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal cocktail. Or you can make it.
Great.
Because I have it in the book.
Well, I was going to ask, obviously the book comes out in December, if I'm not mistaken, and it can be pre-ordered now, but until December, if folks are trying to get their hands on some Italian cocktails, where do you like to go around the city that you think make pretty good ones?
I think Dante's the best. I don't think anyone makes a cocktail like Lyndon Pride. I think he is just an absolute, he's one of those like masters that I talk about. I think he just makes perfect, perfect Italian cocktails in ways that you are unexpected and delightful and amazing. And I can't recommend that place enough. They are actually in the book as well, the New York version, because LA hadn't opened yet by the time I was writing this. I think the Let's Go, they are really into like Amaros that you can't find anywhere else. They're really like, they just dig it. They're in the book as well. They make incredible cocktails. Capri Club as well. They have really fun bartenders who love to mix and experiment with different Italian liqueurs. Those are probably the three that come to mind. They're all in the book because they're all incredible. The Let's Go is much more of a party. Capri Club is much more for just kind of chilling. And Dante is just pure, like, unadulterated Beverly Hills excess, which is great. And then I haven't announced it yet. I don't know when this is going live, but I will be doing some events around LA. At the moment, I have an event that's going to be at Eataly on November 2nd. It's a ticketed event where I'll be doing a cocktail demo and a book signing. I'm going to be at Dante, I think, on November 14th. But that may be a private event. Luca, you'll probably hear about that one. And then I'm talking with a bunch of other places like Capri Club and like the Let's Go to try and figure out to do some bigger, more fun parties. Also Bespoke Bar down on La Cienega, south of the 10, another place that sells really cool like cocktail accoutrements and like rare liqueurs, and they make their own stuff as well, which is, it's a fun place to have a party, which I think we're going to as well. So if you want to get the book earlier, that's one way to do it.
Paul, in the meantime, if people are looking for you, where can they find you? What's the best way to get to look up Paul Feinstein?
My website is mrpaulfeinstein.com, but it's not M-I-S-T-E-R, it's M-R, so like mrpaulfeinstein.com. And that's my Instagram handle. That's my Twitter handle. That's my, X handle. That's my Threads handle. That's my Facebook handle. It's all Mr. Paul Feinstein across all socials and my website.
And can I ask you, or is there did this sort of whet your appetite for more book writing in the future? Is there a topic that you really want to cover in the future that, you know, you're like, oh my God, I wish HarperCollins would email me about that?
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff. Yeah, first of all, yes, I only want to write books. That's all I want to do. It's the most fun. It's the most rewarding. It's like, it's that hits that sweet spot for me of talking to experts, doing tons of research, and having like a product at the end that I can be like, that I can be so proud of. All I want to do with that. And yeah, well, first of all, I have 50 recipes that they didn't publish. So maybe there's a follow-up, but there's also, I've got some food stuff that I will hopefully, be in the works in the not too distant future. So we'll see.
Well, Paul, congratulations. I myself can't wait to read it and start to make some cocktails at home. We got to make sure my bar cart is stocked up, but it sounds like the book has all the directions we need for that. Just want to say thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll be seeing you for an Italian cocktail soon.
Luca, such a pleasure. Looking forward to seeing you at some restaurant sometime soon.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast, dear listener. And thanks to our guest, Paul Feinstein, for dazzling us with tales of Italian cocktails. I sincerely hope you get out there and you buy a copy of his book. I know I will, and I think that everybody in my life can expect to find one in their stocking this holiday season. If you like what you heard, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. I would be forever grateful. Turns out those things really help us make it up the charts on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you're looking for me, you can always find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at the LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountown. You can also find me at LA Food Pod on Instagram. That's LAFOOD POD. We'll be back next week with another epic episode.